Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Close Up Talk Radio, the unique internet broadcast series that brings you together with some of the most amazing, important, and interesting individuals from the worlds of business, industry, travel, art, and entertainment. From company owners, CEOs, and presidents, to the technical wizards behind the scenes who create the magic that make their company's products and services so special. Here is your opportunity to hear firsthand the fascinating stories of how it all happened from those who actually made it possible. This is Close Up Talk Radio. And a good afternoon to you wherever you might be. Hello there, I'm Doug Llewellyn. Nice to have you back with us here on Close Up Talk Radio. This afternoon, a special edition, we're going to be talking about therapy and how much therapy can aid you and help you, whoever you might be and whatever your problems might be. We have a very interesting lady we're going to be talking with now. Her name is Dr. Martha Pierce. She is headquartered out in Denver, Colorado. And for years now, some 30 years, she has provided counseling to adults and couples through her private psychotherapy practice in Denver. She specializes in dealing and working with people who are interested in their own personal growth. And it's pretty interesting. She has a background in journalism. And as she put it, she still has a nose for news. And she has found there are amazing similarities between the two professions. So let's bring Dr. Pierce on with us now and talk to her a little bit about her background, her practice, and how she is able to help people through her psychotherapy practice. Dr. Pierce, good afternoon. How are you today?
Good afternoon. I'm fine. Thank you.
Is it a lovely day in Denver? I hope.
It is gorgeous.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
It's a gorgeous blue sky, 70 degrees, perfect weather.
Oh, perfect. People feel better when the weather is nice, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think sunshine and light are very, very important to both mental and physical well-being. One of the reasons I live in Denver is that we have sunshine about 300 days a year.
Well, good for you. You're lucky. Let me ask you a question. I'm intrigued by the fact that you have a background in journalism. Tell me a little bit about that and then how you got into what you're doing now. What did you do in the world of journalism?
Well, I was an old-fashioned newspaper reporter. This was way back in the day. I had majored in journalism in college, and then eventually after graduating, I got a job on a newspaper in Wichita, Kansas. And I worked there for a few years, and I enjoyed it very, very much. It's a great way to get to know a city. And over time, I didn't work anymore, and there were some family tragedies that came up, and it sort of made me think more about psychology. I had always been interested in it, but when I was in college, I much preferred, getting married than going to graduate school, so I kind of skipped that part at that time.
Okay.
So I ended up in psychology, and I was just so angry with myself. I thought, wow, I've wasted 10 years. Well, I didn't waste it. There are just amazing similarities. These are people's stories. People's stories are important. It's about, identity is important, and stories are about people's identity. You know, there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end sometimes, and there's very often a mystery theme. It's sort of like a good detective novel.
Well, that's very interesting to hear that there is such a similarity between the two. On the surface, you probably wouldn't think that. Well, in any event, you are...
No, and that's why I was surprised that I hadn't wasted those 10 years.
Yeah. Well, you are a licensed clinical psychologist. It's interesting, people hear the terms psychologist and psychiatrist, and sometimes there is some confusion in their mind as to what the difference is. So right here at the outset, why don't I ask you that? Tell me the difference between a psychologist, which is what you are, and a psychiatrist. How do you answer that?
Well, a psychiatrist is a medical doctor, and only psychiatrists can prescribe medications. Now, this is changing some. There are several states that are going to try to enter the prescription writing business in terms of mental health. Colorado is certainly not one of them. This is a very young movement, so it's kind of going nowhere right now. A psychologist goes to graduate school. And I think in terms of length of time and intensity of training, they're very similar, but they're their topics are different. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor. These days, young psychiatrists are primarily concerned with prescribing medication and managing medication because medications have changed so much for the better in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Psychologists do therapy, and the new psychiatrists don't do therapy quite so much as they do manage meds. You know, but we are still in the talking business in psychology.
Okay. Okay. And you are a PhD versus an MD, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Well, maybe we've spelled that out. Let me talk a little bit about your practice. You have written, it's pretty interesting that you now have a rather small practice and you conduct your practice out of your home. And you said you used to have a traditional office. Then you knew you dressed up, you wore suits and everything all the time, dressed to go to the office, rather formal. But now, with your home practice, you can be very casually dressed, almost wear whatever you want, and have found that people are more comfortable with you in this environment than they were in the traditional office environment. And as a result, they seem to do better in their improvement. Is that really true?
That's absolutely true, and it surprised me. You know, we have lots of rules in mental health about keeping boundaries and not sharing too many of your personal stories and sort of not getting our lives mixed up in our clients' lives. We really need to keep them separate. So when I moved home, to my home, it was back in the 90s when managed care was kind of taking over and there were, shall we say, great financial differences. And mm-hmm. I really couldn't afford an office anymore, even though I had a full practice. So I moved home, and I was just terrified. I really was. I thought, people are going to see my pictures. They're going to see what kind of taste I have. You know, what about this? What about that? What if they want to go in the kitchen? Well, none of that happened, and it turned out people were so much more comfortable, as I was, if we were all wearing jeans and sitting around, and the dog walks through the room, and you know, all those things just worked out fine, and people really commented about it. So I know it's true. They're another surprise in my practice.
And do you find that I would imagine at the outset you may have been concerned of whether people would even come to a private home. Was that true?
Well, yeah, that's somewhat true. I think on the East Coast, you know, where property is so much more expensive than it is out here,
mm-hmm.
Lots of therapists just could not afford an office at all, and so they saw people in their apartments or in their homes. And I know some psychiatrists that have a practice in their homes. But it's kind of, it's regional and it's cultural, and it seems to be changing all the time. But more and more people are having home offices.
Wow. Well, that's quite interesting. Let's talk about your practice and your dog.
I was going to ask you
about Wally or Gracie, your pups' names. And I know they help you in your practice, don't they?
Absolutely.
How do they help? How does that work?
I have to go back to Wally. I lost Wally last summer, and this is a new dog. Gracie's my new dog.
Okay.
And she's a little younger, so she's sort of in training. She's sort of my apprentice. But she has the same sensitivity that old Wally. Wally was a great big dog. I mean a big dog, about 110 pounds, and Pyrenees Ridgeback mix.
Oh,
and
boy.
he would just kind of lie around and be in the room with us. And then if people, you know, express some sadness or grief, he would go over and put his head down on their feet. And if they were keeping something from me, he was known to get in the chair with him, and my chair isn't big enough for, you know, a person and a dog that size.
Mm-hmm.
And even Gracie, if she's out in the backyard and somebody starts crying and I'm a whole house away, she knows it and she comes running in. I think dogs are very sensitive to people's feelings.
I definitely agree with that there.
I think they're the best healers. They really are.
You really do think they help people and help them respond. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to ask you a question, Doug. Do you remember, I don't know if you remember as a kid or if you had this situation, but when those of us from the middle of the country wanted to run away, we decided against it and cried into our dog's fur instead. And it's amazing how people still do that.
Well, look, you're talking to a dog lover here who frequently has a German Shepherd at my lap, so I appreciate and I sympathize and certainly understand exactly what you're saying there. I've seen how helpful pets can be in hospital situations to help people, brighten their day and just, in fact, make their day when they come in to visit patients who've, been hospitalized for a long period of time. It's a terrific thing.
It is, and I hope Gracie gets there one day. One of the fantasies I have is to maybe a little bit later on when she's just a little bit older, because she is a shepherd, she's a Belgian shepherd, have her, I would like to start working more with vets coming back from the wars. And I think having a dog like this and this kind of shepherd, she's actually a Malinois, are the new police dogs and the new military dogs. So that this kind of dog would be very familiar to those people. And I think there's a great need for that. I know there's a great need for that right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your practice. What kind of client, or is there a specific kind of client or type of client that you deal with primarily? Or do you just kind of run the gamut?
Well, let's start with who I don't see. I don't see children. I don't think I'm as good at that as I am at other things. I love doing individual work with adults and with couples. So I would say pretty much that's my practice now. Now, over time, I've always had a private practice, and I've almost always had some sort of hospital affiliation. But I don't necessarily see people who are in a hospital for mental health reasons. I see people who have cancer, who have chronic illness, who are dying. And I come from a medical family, a familiar territory to me. And I very much enjoy that. In fact, my favorite population, if I have to narrow it down, is working with cancer patients. They're the most wonderful, alive people I've ever met.
And when they come to you, what brings them to you? What are they seeking? What are they looking for in general?
Are you talking about regular, everyday folks or cancer patients?
I'm talking about both. Let's focus on cancer patients. How about them? When they come to you, what specifically are they looking for?
Well, first of all, they're scared, and they want to talk to somebody, and they don't particularly want to burden their family with it, with their concerns. Everybody's very protective of everybody else, and cancer's a scary thing. It's less so now than it was a few years ago. But, we usually start there. I usually ask them, what has the doctor told them, because I don't want to plant any ideas that come from me. I want to know what they're thinking and what they're feeling and what they're afraid of and what they're concerned about. So, from there we kind of run the gamut from helping people keep on track to keeping their hope up, because there's always something to hope for, to having couples come in and learn better communication and, just things like that. But in terms of my regular practice, I think people come in for varied reasons. Some of them are depressed. We see a lot of depressed people. In fact, you see a lot of that in medical patients, too. And I see couples and people who have difficulties in communication and just kind of everyday problems, people who are in a divorce, people who are having difficulties with somebody in the family. Just about anything you can imagine. I don't, now that I'm here at the house, I don't see people who have really, really serious mental illnesses because, it's just my house. There isn't anybody here but me. And,
right.
So I would rather stay away from that right now. But in the past, I used to just see about everybody who walked in the door.
Well, getting back to the cancer patients first, are these cancer patients who, number one, have been informed that, they may have that they are dying, that they could be dying, or not necessarily?
No, they've been informed. I think many, many years ago, doctors did not tell their patients if they were dying. They might tell a family member, but they wouldn't tell the patients. And then that totally turned around, and for a while they were telling them too much. Well, you're going to die in 6 months, and it just scared the daylights out of people. And I think now it's more moderate. I think the younger physicians are much better trained in communication and in compassion and sympathy, much more so than the docs who just want to give a shot or a pill or do surgery and not really have a relationship with the patient. So that's changed a lot, but everybody who comes in is afraid of that.
Well, that brings up a question. How do you deal with someone who's been informed that, you know, their disease is fatal, that they have a shortened time left here on the face of this earth? That must be very difficult to deal with them. What do you do? How do you approach that?
Well, I don't find it difficult at all because, as I said before, I think these are the most alive people I've ever met. You know, I ask them what that means to them. You know, how's the family? Do you talk about it? Do you not talk about it? You know, what's going on with all the people around them? Have they finished their unfinished business, so to speak? You know, is there anybody they need to heal a relationship with? But mostly I just let them talk about what's important. And the difference is that, you know, in regular practice, so many people come in and they want to feel better, but they don't particularly want to do any work. Cancer patients work. They know their time is limited. There's no BS, no fooling around. Let's just get to it.
Okay. Cool. Interesting. How do you then, you know, deal with other people that are just people who come in and they need some advice? They're stressed, they have problems with their marriage or whatever it might be, or their jobs, and they come to you to talk, to look for help, and that's really it. You don't prescribe medication for them, do you?
No, I don't. I don't at all.
No?
So it's just, I'm forbidden from doing that, actually.
You listen and advise.
I listen and advise, and I try to help people figure out their own situation. When people come in and say something like, do hypnosis on me, make me quit smoking, or make me not be so angry, I say, I can't do that, but I will help you figure out a way. And we just talk, and things just sort of, I mean, it's really kind of hard to explain, sorry, but things just sort of evolve. Once they talk, I can see things, I can anticipate things, and my job is really to ask the right questions. They have to do the work, which means they have to do the thinking, they have to do the repair of the relationships, and I will give them lots of helpful hints, but I won't tell them they have to do this or have to do that, you know, in order to fix something. Because it's not my problem, it's theirs.
Right. How successful are you in helping, for example, couples who are having marital problems and come to you? You're not really just a marriage counselor, but are you put in that position at times?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, like a lot of other psychologists, we're trained in many areas. We don't just get trained in one.
Right.
I mean, some of the people who aren't licensed at all may just learn some counseling skills and, you know, things like that. But we have specific training and things like that. So I've been trained in couples therapy. But one of the things that I do, and very often what happens is the woman comes in and they have been married for about 10 years, and I honestly could give them a script. She says, he won't talk to me. He won't listen to me. He won't do things with me. He ignores me. So I say, well, why isn't he in here with you? And they said, well, he won't come. And I said, well, you tell him that I need to get his side of the story. Well, guess what? The guy who says he doesn't want to come comes in and talks my ear off. And it's really interesting because they can really get involved in it. But the first thing I ask couples is I try to figure out, is this a communication problem? Which most often it is, and nothing is black and white one or the other. But the other issue is this a values issue? That's much more difficult to deal with.
And when you say values, that,
well,
what,
values
is it, what
issue,
do you mean?
I mean, like, well, values issue, should we have another baby?
Okay.
I want to be born again. What about you? I want to live where in the West where it's dry and sunny, but you don't. So those are really tough issues. Communication is easy. First thing
when
I do with people is teach them how to fight with each other.
You teach them how to fight. Interesting.
Teach them how to fight. Well, and by that, that's...
How do you do that?
Well, I use the term loosely. Well, I actually have a little exercise that I put people through, and I didn't invent it. Somebody invented it about 30 years ago. But there's a little exercise that I've sort of made mine called a fair fight. And it's very behavioral, it's very structured, and it's very simple, or so it sounds. It's not so simple to do. And so I teach people how to bring up things on a regular basis. I say, go home and have the Tuesday night fights. And I ask them to pick things that are simple to resolve, and the things that most people sort of dismiss as not important, so they're not going to talk about it, like, you know, leaving your dirty clothes all over the floor, or not doing the dishes, or something like that. And that helps them not be afraid of conflict. They have a structure, they're used to it, they're comfortable with it, and it's very behavioral. And they are prepared to resolve conflict, because it's really not about fighting, but about resolving conflict, when something really important does come up.
Okay.
And people are very successful with that. They really are.
You really caught me there when you said somebody says to you, I want to be born again, and the others may not be born. Is that from a religious aspect, or is there something
right.
else there that I don't understand?
No. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear about that. I meant from a religious aspect.
Oh, okay.
So religion, where you live, how many kids you have,
yeah.
What about my in-laws? You hate them, you know. things like that are more value-laden, and they're more they're really difficult to talk about.
How long, typically, does it take for you to really be able to help somebody so that they, you know, they're beginning to feel better about their issues? You don't do it in one-hour session, do you? I mean, I would assume it takes
generally not. I tell you what, I've seen a few young women from one of the health clinics around lately. These are generally young women who've gotten pregnant, or they've lost a baby and it's very painful for them. Sometimes I can really help those people in 1 hour, but normally it's not that. But, you know, it's anywhere from a few weeks to a few months. It varies with every person. There's, you know, one size does not fit all.
Sure.
What I do ask of people is if this is going to take a while, I say, I don't care if you can afford it or not. I want you, if you're going to do your work, come in every week for the first month. Then we can back off to every other week if you don't have money, and I'll float you along. Because
right.
it's important to keep up your momentum. You can't come in once a month and expect to get much done.
You find it's easier working with men or women, or does it not really matter much?
Well, I enjoy working with men. I also enjoy working with women. One of the things that I've, not everybody feels that way, but some people just want to work with kids. They don't want to see adults at all. But I find that gender differences are incredibly important in people's relationships. Now, one of the things I was trained in many years ago was sex therapy. Well, we hardly do sex therapy anymore because sex is everywhere. Everybody knows about it. There's not much ignorance anymore because it's everywhere you go.
Yeah.
So people who come in with sexual problems very often have relationship problems.
No, there's more to it than sex.
Yeah, no.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I said what you mean is there's more to it there than just sex.
Yes, and I think that explaining gender issues and how men and women see their lives and all parts of their lives in a different way really helps people a lot, I think, because we don't always think about it. I think that a lot of people who came of age during the 70s or 80s or 90s, you know, think that feminism has come and gone, and if you're a feminist, you hate men. Well, that's simply not true at all. But it's important to understand. Let me give you an example. Men and women see sex differently. In fact, there was a wonderful old New Yorker cartoon that had a middle-aged couple. They're each sitting in their Easy Boy recliners, and they're each holding up a sign. And his says, no sex, no love. Hers says, no love, no sex. That just sums it up.
Yep,
so men and women see sex differently, and they see intimacy differently. You know, a man might want you to sit with him while he watches a football game. Don't talk, just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman doesn't understand that. She wants to talk. She wants to get up and start a conversation before he has breakfast. He says, leave me alone. Just give me my coffee.
Yep, that's the way it works. That's pretty general, I think.
Well,
so do you get them to open up then and talk to you? Men are much harder to get to open up, though, aren't they, than women in general?
I think it depends. Well, you know, what I said before was true. Sometimes when men come in after they say they didn't want to come, they talk my arm off. I can't get them to be quiet.
Yeah.
You know, and I say that in a loving way. But they say they don't want to come, but once they start and the floodgates open.
Let me ask you a question. What do you think it is that brings people to you? Because, you know, there are a lot of people who do, professionals who do the kind of thing, the work that you do. How does one go about selecting a therapist, you know, or a psychologist to go to see? How do you recommend people?
Well, I think that's very complicated. Lots of folks will say, go see your family physician. Well, frankly, I don't think family physicians know any more therapists than the one they go to. So I think there are lots of good ways to do it. Sometimes word of mouth is good. If you have a friend or a colleague who's been in therapy and they had a good experience, that's a pretty good referral. There are professional associations. Every mental health profession has an association that has a database, and you can, say, go to the Colorado Psychological Association and plug in where you live, what the gender of therapist you want, if you care. You look at their list of specialties, see if they have experience in the kind of problem you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, practically, what kind of eyes do they have? And so some people will take that, but you really have to go once, because matching personality is just as important almost than the particular profession or the particular degree you have. Now, that's not totally true, but you have to have a good match, and sometimes you have to meet in order to do that.
You bring up a question there. You know, some people can do this kind of dealing with therapists by telephone. They can do it on Skype sometimes, and it works for them. It's effective. How do you feel about that, or do you think it's really the only way it really works is face-to-face?
Well,
do you do telephone counseling as well?
Teletherapy is a brand new field, and there are lots of caveats about it. For one thing, Skype is not secure. So there are a handful of, providers that can get you a secure connection. Now, this is great for some of the places that are sparsely populated. Like, we have a lot of farmland out here and mountain communities, you know, places where there aren't any therapists. I mean, a lot of people who have all that education, they want to stay in a big city where all the action is. So sometimes that really helps. And like medicine is doing this now, too, with diagnosis via Skype or whatever. And I think it's a godsend for people in that situation. If you're in town, the only time I do that is when somebody's sick or they're snowed in. And that does happen occasionally out here.
Well, yes. All right. So, and you really do think that in person works more effectively? Now, obviously,
absolutely.
You're in Denver.
I mean, you're talking tone of voice. You're talking body language.
Language, right?
You know, there are lots of subtle things you pick up on. I can read people well enough after all this time that when they walk in the door, I can see whether they're depressed or not. I can just see things. I may not put it together right that second. But then by the end of the hour, it kind of makes sense to me the way they look, you know, why they look the way they do.
Well, listen, this has been fascinating chatting with you, Dr. Pierce. We've been talking to Dr. Martha Pierce. She's from Denver, Colorado. That's where her practice is located. And she actually has her practice in her home. And as you heard us say, she thinks it has been much more effective for her working with people because they're so much more comfortable with you. I think that's terrific. Dr. Pierce, we've run out of time. I thank you for your time today. Most interesting chatting with you. I appreciate it.
I thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. Okay.
All right.
And that's it for now, everybody. We're out of time for this edition of Close Up Talk Radio. We'll talk to you next time. Hopefully you'll be able to join us. We have great guests. I'm Doug Llewellyn, and that'll wrap it up for this session. We will see you next time. Bye. Have a great day, everybody.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.